Good evening. My name is Peter Berg. I'm head of special collections, and I'd like to welcome you to the final chapter of this spring semester's Michigan Writers Series. I'm delighted that you came on such a beautiful evening, but I think you're going to enjoy the best of both worlds, one inside, one outside. There'll be plenty of time after the reading, in fact, to enjoy the rest of the evening. I'm very, very pleased and honored to welcome our reader for tonight, Jim Daniels. Jim Daniels is a member of the English department at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. He was born in Detroit, so he's a native Michiganian. He lives with his wife, the writer Kristen Kovacic, and their two children, Ramsey and Rosalie, in Pittsburgh. He is the author of five books of poetry, Blue Jesus, Blessing the House, M80, Punching Out, and Places Everyone, which won the Brittingham Prize for Poetry in 1985. In addition, he is the author of a collection of short stories, No Pets, and edited or co-edited the following anthologies: American Poetry, The Next Generation, Letters to America, Contemporary American Poetry on Race, and the Carnegie Mellon Anthology of Poetry. He wrote the screenplay for No Pets, a 1994 independent feature film. I didn't know you did that. That's very interesting. Directed by Tony Buba, and the one-act play Heart of Hearts, produced off-Broadway in 1998. His awards include an NEA Fellowship, two fellowships from the Pennsylvania Council for the Arts, and a Pushcart Prize. And I'd just like to end by saying I'm doubly pleased and honored that Jim Daniels' papers are deposited in special collections here as part of the Michigan Writers Collection. It's a collection that I think reflects the vitality, beauty, and strength of writers from Michigan, and I'm very pleased that Jim's papers are among those. I'd like to welcome Jim Daniels.
Thank you, Peter, and it's certainly an honor for me to have my papers collected here. It's been incentive for me since Peter first approached me about the papers a number of years ago, because I feel like, well, I have to keep publishing these books or else, you know, it'll look like it was a total bust, and those papers, no one's going to want to ever look at those papers. So actually, I'd like to read from the two new books, No Pets and Blue Jesus. So I'll start off with a short story and then move into some poems. This story is called Movie Stars, and it's about a trip to downtown Detroit. A kid and his mother, they both wear glasses, and the occasion of the trip is to see the eye doctor. The father, who's absent from the story, is kind of a figure here because of his absence. The kid comes from a large family, and the father's not around very much, which in a way prompts the mother to do what she does in the story, just as a little background. Movie stars. Get your coat on, my mother said. We'll miss our bus. My brothers and sisters were at school, so my mother and I were alone in the silent house. It suddenly seemed huge, and I lingered in my room, lazily swaying between the two empty bunk beds where all the boys slept. She stood in the doorway smiling. Does somebody want to stop at the Coney Island for lunch? She asked. I grinned. I'd worn glasses from the age of three. I scratched the lenses on cement. I broke off temple pieces. I took them off and forgot them in strange places. Once they were missing for a week until turning up in a neighbor's milk chute. I had carefully placed them there while we had a free-for-all. Most of our games involved trying to inflict bodily harm on each other. One time, both temple pieces were torn off during a game of kill the guy with the ball. I was used to seeing wads of white tape in my peripheral vision. I was the only kid in my family who wore them, me and my mother. My parents were still married, though later they'd both say it was only for our sake. The house was small, so they had to sleep together in the same bed. They couldn't avoid touching each other, I guess, because they kept having children in between battles. They could never decide how old we'd have to be before it'd be okay to split up. Finally, after we all moved out, they quickly got divorced. My brothers and I would lay awake on our bunks in silence, listening while they fought. I kept my eyes open, believing this would make it end sooner. All I could see above me was the faint outline of the bedboards beneath the top bunk where my oldest brother Steve lay. My glasses sat folded on the dresser. I could reach out and touch them to make sure they were there. And sometimes I did. Occasionally, after a particularly long, ugly fight, my father disappeared. Once I heard my mother whispering loudly on the phone, "Get back here, you coward." I hated when she cried. I ran outside and cried myself. My father always returned. He never packed anything when he left. He'd just storm out. We'd hear the door slam, the car start, and my mother's fists pounding something. Some days, I still hear my mother's loud whisper in the wind, "Get back here." "We won't be late, Mom," I said. 10 years old, I was trying to take better care of my glasses. Suddenly, I was combing my hair on a regular basis, though I couldn't say why. I grabbed my winter coat and we hurried out to stand alone at the cold corner and wait. I danced on the curb, craning my neck to spot our bus down the long straight line of 8 Mile Road. My mother was counting change. I was counting my good luck to have bad eyes and my mother all to myself. We had to change buses at the fairgrounds. My job was to hold the transfers. I loved the idea of getting another ticket, getting on another bus, continuing the journey. "Could we get transfers and go all the way to Florida?" I asked as we climbed aboard. We'd never been to Florida, never would go, that heaven we dreamed of during our long gray winters. The bus driver snorted, "You can get as far as River Rouge, but there ain't no beaches in River Rouge, just snow, same as here." "We'll be lucky if we ever get as far as Ohio," my mother said as we stepped to the back of the bus, sitting next to each other in the middle of the last row where the seat went all the way across. Anyone getting on would be walking down the aisle toward my mother, queen of the bus. She wore makeup and perfume to go to town, and to me, she looked glamorous. She was dyeing her hair blonde even back then, and it was poofed up with hairspray. My father worked for Chrysler's, like most everybody in our neighborhood. He smoked Lucky's non-filtered till they seemed to disappear into his lips. My mother smoked True Blue. True Green was the menthol brand. My mother liked to say True Blue, winking when she said it. I watched the buildings grow taller, the streets cleaner. I squirmed and twisted on the vinyl seat, and so did my mother. We only had one car, so my mother was usually stuck with us at home. I could tell she loved these bus trips, too. Downtown was a world of magic entrances, revolving doors, escalators, elevators. The smell hit me as soon as I stepped off the bus. Possibility. My mother was getting her eyes checked, too. She wore cat-eye frames, which my father hated. "Meow," she said to that. After all six kids were in school, she took a job at the Knights of Columbus Credit Union down the street. My father was a member because their bar served cheap drinks and they had a good bowling league. What made it good, I don't know, but that's what he told us. This all probably makes my dad sound like a lunkhead. Some of the time he was, but he was a thinker too. That was his problem, thinking made him unhappy or not having enough time to think. His big hobby was the weather, and he had ambitions of being a TV weatherman. The most popular local weatherman, Sonny Day, drove him absolutely nuts. "I bet Sonny's not even his real name," he'd say, as if that were some great insight. Sonny had this shtick. He'd say, "Tomorrow there'll be clouds and rain, so it's going to be Claney." And he'd write Claney on his map of Michigan. Part of the Upper Peninsula detached from the map, and he used to take it off and wave it around. A real riot. Dr. Keith's office was in one of the old skyscrapers downtown where everything shone and smelled like polish. I felt like I was entering the church of some other religion, a better one, when we walked into the huge lobby. My mother held my hand when we got on the elevator, something we never did at home, or she didn't have enough hands for all of us. She was a different person on those trips. My father had had bad eyes. They might have been happier. We had little family in Detroit. My father was an only child, and both his parents had died in a car accident shortly after his marriage. My mother had family, but it was back in Arkansas. She'd met my father when he was stationed there in the Army. Our neighbors were busy raising their own kids, who were all around our ages, so there were no babysitters to be had. My father worked a lot of overtime during those years anyway. The point is, they never went anywhere without us. In the doctor's office, I quickly scanned the kids' magazines because once we got our drops, they'd simply be taunting me. The drops did something to our eyes which made everything blurry. Their only plus was that afterwards we got to wear these cheap plastic dark glasses and we could pretend to be movie stars. I was always Jackie Gleason, and my mother was always Lucy, Lucille Ball. "And away we go," I'd say. I picked Jackie Gleason because he was so fat, he seemed like the biggest star, and he had my name, and I was a bit of a butterball myself. My father loved Jackie, who was on TV every Saturday night, the one night we spent together as a family, bath night, and we always fought to get our baths in before Jackie came on. I felt clean just thinking about it, clean and happy, piled on the couch with everyone I loved, nobody fighting, everybody laughing, even when we didn't get the jokes. "Oh, Ricky," my mom would say to any little thing I did, or "wah, wah, wah." She and my father never fought the way Ricky and Lucy fought on TV, half joking, ready to make up. With my parents, the stakes were always higher. Their fights lasted a long time, even if they were over grocery money or a stain on the carpet, a lawn full of weeds or a broken window, and who was going to fix it, who was going to pay. The doctor was amazed. The muscle weakness which made me cross-eyed was continuing to correct itself. If it kept improving, I wouldn't need glasses anymore. I didn't share his enthusiasm. Without glasses, I'd be just like the other kids. I sulked alone in the waiting room while my mother got examined. It'd be hours before the drops wore off. At the Coney Island down the block, where we always ate after our checkups, we'd sit at the counter by the bathrooms where we could watch everybody while we ate. I'd eat two hot dogs with everything, cheese, onions, chili, french fries, large root beer. I didn't know if my mother had enough money, but if this was going to be one of our last trips downtown together, I wanted to make sure it was memorable. My mother emerged, beaming in her movie star glasses. "Cha, cha, cha," she cried, jumping up and down. My mother would do anything on those trips. An old man reading Time magazine looked up, startled, then frowned. She ignored him. "Isn't it wonderful, sweetie? You might not have to wear glasses anymore. And you look so handsome without your glasses. The girls will be crawling all over you." She took me in her arms. The top of my head reached her shoulder, which put my face uncomfortably close to her breasts. I pulled away. "I don't want girls crawling all over me," I said. "Just wait and see," she said. Putting on her coat, she knocked her dark glasses off. The shock of seeing her naked eyes frightened me, and I quickly picked up the glasses and handed them to her. Mine fell off while I was bending down, and she started laughing hysterically. "The blind leading the blind," she said. "Now where's our seeing-eye dog?" She started groping around. "Is that you, sweetie?" she said to the coat-tree. "My, how you've grown." I started laughing, too. My mother's laugh was dangerously contagious. It often got her in trouble at home, my father asking, "What's so funny?" He was usually immune to it, though. It seemed to infect everybody else. Even the old man was smiling now as we careened out the door and down the hall toward the elevator. I was laughing, but I felt a cold burn inside. I was hungry, but it was more than that. No more trips downtown, girls crawling all over me. What next? Back through the revolving door and onto the street, my mother hurried, looking at her watch. She suddenly stopped in the middle of the wide sidewalk and turned to me. "Jackie," she said, streaming words together like she did when she was nervous. "You remember Mr. Coggins' brother, the man who lived next door when the Cogginses went away last year? You know, you're going to be such a handsome young man, I should start calling you Jack, you know that? Anyway, Jack, Bill, Mr. Coggins' brother, he teaches here in town, and I think he's going to meet us for lunch." She seemed much too cheery, as if she was trying to will her excitement onto me. She quickly grabbed my arm and started walking again, touching her hair as if to adjust something, though the spray held each hair rigidly in place. She had said what she needed to say and did not want a response. "You think he's going to meet us," was all I could think to say as she yanked me along. We never ate out as a family. I mean, never. "Take six kids to a restaurant, are you kidding?" my father'd say, reaching back to pat his wallet to make sure it was still there. I told him we'd be there, and he said he'd try to meet us. "Now let's hurry. We don't need nobody having lunch with us." I didn't like Bill Coggins. He told me to call him Bill when he lived next door, and I never called any grown-ups by their first name. He was that kind of guy, someone I'd later call a smoothie once I learned the word. His older brother had gotten a temporary assignment in California for 6 months and took his family with him. Bill, younger, single, moved in to keep an eye on things and enjoy the free rent. The Cogginses never quite fit into our neighborhood. They kept to themselves. When they went away, it took a while for anyone to even notice. But then the young, handsome stranger was spotted, and that gave everyone something to talk about, particularly after my mother was seen leaning over the fence into their yard and laughing that laugh on a regular basis while my father was away at work. Bill Coggins was a school teacher out for the summer, so he had time on his hands. When my mother noticed him in his yard, she'd go to the bathroom to spruce up, then step outside to check on her flower garden. That's what was next. We're having lunch with Bill Coggins. I wasn't going to call him Bill. I knew that much. We sat at a booth instead of the counter so there'd be room for him. She let me order, but she herself just had coffee, hoping, I guess, to eat with Bill Coggins. I had to strain my neck to see as my mother pointed out a ridiculous hat, a pretty dress, a bad toupee. She was charged up even before her second cup. The Cogginses had been back from California for 6 months. I had known my mother had even spoken to Bill once he moved out. While we waited, I read her facts about U.S. presidents printed on the sugar packets. She nodded distractedly, her eyes trained on the doorway. "What's a Whig?" I asked. "What's a Whig?" "I don't know, dear," she replied. "I don't know. Do you think Dad knows?" I asked. She closed her eyes and sighed, but she didn't answer. I quickly went to work on my two hot dogs when they arrived. "Jackie, you're making a mess," she said, though usually she didn't care. I could feel chili dripping over my chin. I swiped at my face with a napkin and took another huge bite. "What's your hurry? Give me a bite, will you?" I reluctantly handed her the last dog and she ripped it in half. She had taken off her dark glasses, even though we weren't supposed to, not yet. "He teaches chemistry," she said. "He's a scientist." "He ain't coming," I said hopefully. I slurped my root beer, sucking the last sips from between ice cubes. The waitress suddenly appeared. "Will there be anything else?" she asked, her check in her hand. At the counter, they never bothered us. I wanted to spin around like we did on the stools, both of us laughing, not caring. Wedged between the bench and the table, I felt like we were already on the bus headed home. I sat up on my feet and looked around. The restaurant had filled with businessmen in suits. "Yes, yes, there will," my mother said, and she ordered two hot dogs for herself. "You want another one?" she asked, pulling me back into my seat. I nodded eagerly. "Another root beer, too?" "Yeah, a float," I said. "A root beer float, please." I knew I had her at a disadvantage. She frowned, but the waitress was already gone, my dirty plate shedding used napkins behind her. I took off my dark glasses, too. "Oh, well," she said, her voice cracking slightly. We waited in silence now, as if she really was blind to everything around us. Her hands nervously pulled at the large gold buttons of her dress, like she was trying to squeeze them smaller. She tore into her hot dogs when they came, the chili stained the corners of her mouth. I had never eaten three before. I had never even dreamed of three. But I found the room for another and forced down a last bite. My mother ate them so fast she had to order herself dessert to kill more time. The waitress just wanted us to leave, though the lunch crowd was beginning to thin out. I was stuffing my pockets with sugar packets. "He must have gotten busy and couldn't get away," she said. "He wanted me to call him Bill," I said, as if that explained everything. Even back then, I knew school teachers had a set lunch hour. My mother looked at her watch again. She never wore a watch at home. "Shit," she said, which she never said, only when something precious broke. We had few precious things. "We've got to run." "I got to use the bathroom," I said suddenly. I was ready to explode. "Well, hurry up then," she snapped and started counting out the money for the bill. When I came out, she was standing at the counter by the door waiting for me. My stomach was cramped, so I took slow, careful steps. "You're going to make us late," she said. "Let's go." As we got to the door, the waitress ran up. "Something wrong with the service?" she spat out. My mother had left no tip. "I'm sorry, I just have enough for bus fare home. I thought I had more. I'm sorry." "Get out of here," the waitress said, pointing as if we didn't know the way. I thought my mother might cry, but she just stumbled out onto the sidewalk in a daze. She ran ahead to the bus stop, leaving me to follow. A bus was pulling away, probably ours. "Don't tell your father about this," she pleaded angrily as we stood waiting forever for the next bus. She didn't mean the expensive lunch. She didn't mean being late. It began to rain, and we had no umbrella. My father had predicted rain, but he usually did. While he was inside the dark factory all day, he didn't want anybody else having any sunshine. The bus ride home seemed incredibly slow, my mother sighing in irritation at every slow person getting off or on. I looked over at her watch. My brothers and sisters were on their way home from school with no one at home to meet them. When we finally got to our stop, my mother yanked me down the steps. From the corner, I could see the others sitting on the porch or playing in the snow. My youngest sister, Abby, was crying. Andy and Eric were spinning around a telephone pole. The others were having a free-for-all on the lawn with some of the neighbor kids. Mrs. Hunter from across the street was talking to my brother, Steve. He spotted us and pointed. My mother began wildly sprinting up the street, holding the house key tight in her fist. I ran behind her, yelling, "Hey! Hey!" She held her arms high above her, reaching up as if something was trying to pull her under. "We missed our bus," she was shouting, almost gasping. It was close enough to the truth, and I wasn't telling. Movie stars have all kinds of secrets. I tossed my glasses on top of a snowbank. Then I ran up and leaped onto the pile of bodies wrestling in the snow. Thanks. That was my attempt at fiction. Anytime I publish a short story, I feel like I'm getting away with something. This new book is called Blue Jesus, and there's a series of poems in here comprise the first section of the book. And I've never really read them as a group before. I thought this might be an appropriate occasion to see how they go. This book really literally just came out. And I don't even know how to introduce the series, so I'll just get started and see what happens. First is called Yellow Jesus. Can you keep a secret? I have seen halos around the heads of beautiful women. Okay, shoot me with a well-intentioned folk song. I'm telling the truth till it hurts. I love the body. I love the sonic boom boom of the heart after skin touches skin. When I was young and my pores clogged with pure impurity, I took pleasure in squeezing out the pus that you're not supposed to squeeze. We all know the poison's in there. It was nice to see some of it come out now and then and wipe it away and imagine I might live 30 more good seconds. We have stained the walls of churches with candle smoke for a long time and counting. A little bit of hell to heat up the holy water. I try to keep the faith and keep the fires burning. Yellow Jesus is the sun, your good eye, and the moon, your evil eye. Some mornings I stand naked at the window while my favorite saint sleeps on, and I see them both in the clear blue, my two yellow friends, and I could believe in anything. And this next one is called the Red Jesus. Maybe you're beginning to get the idea here. I guess if I were going to describe them, I would say these poems are like prayers of an agnostic or something along those lines. Red Jesus. I see him in the struck match and in the dead leaf wandering, stepped on. He burns my ears with the angry pulse of what I don't understand. He lives in the clenched. He is the knock at the door when I do not wish. He is the red fingers. He is not blood, but what causes blood to appear. I miss him even when I am gently brushing a stranger's hair. He can hold his breath longer than anyone. His throne is the electric chair. His every vowel is a contest, and we're stepping on each other's throats to get the medals. Even as I sleep, my fingers curl inward on his smile. Green Jesus. Green Jesus has been erased from the hymnals and turned into a three-prong outlet. The lustful priest hit him in his guitar at the folk mass, but no one was fooled. His sweat nourished the rectory's houseplant when they broke him down and he confessed. Back to the organ stomp and shriek. Green Jesus guzzles poison, then reappears between sidewalk cracks. Green Jesus of the hillside meadow, the smooth curve, the beautiful chaos. He accepts no folded letters. He says, "Why not admit your ignorance?" He whispers, "This is as loud as it gets." The lustful priest happily goes deaf. Green Jesus stains the knees of the blessed children. When you call him, he does not answer. He is sarcasm's greatest enemy. He is the circular prayer, the spinning wheel. We make our money green. We call green lucky. We call it inexperienced. We scrub it out. This is Blue Jesus. Sleepless and the clock hands throbbing. I have to get on the red phone to the Blue Jesus of my dreams and say, help or squeak or who was that monster at my door, Satan or the ghost of J. Edgar Hoover? Blue Jesus smears the ink of my dreams, wandering like the ridiculous cape of the artist wannabe at the dull party, beautiful no matter who wears it. I'm knocking at his door. It's pretty dark in there. Maybe it comes down to trusting the mirages, the shadows, the unfinished. Purple Jesus. Jesus, I'm not done with you. Are you done with me? Last week I stopped in a church to look at a box they say holds some holy bones, just to say I was there. You have to take it on faith that I was there, that I saw the box, that the bones were in the box, that the bones were St. Valentine's, that St. Valentine was a holy man, holy enough to join the frat, that the people who let him in weren't fools to begin with, filling each other's underwear with shaving cream. You see what I'm saying? I haven't even gotten anywhere near what it takes to believe in you. I walked into the smell of purple Jesus rising in sweet incense, like one beautiful letter repeating itself above our heads. Purple Jesus makes me shut up and admire the dust I'm headed for. My mother can't kneel anymore. She sits during the kneeling parts, on the edge of the pew, so she's not quite comfortable, so her knees almost touch the kneeler. She believes the somber purple Jesus knows she'd be kneeling if it didn't hurt quite so much. Purple Jesus, my favorite crayon, you don't make me a soldier in your army. You don't ask for the numb repeated prayer. You simply want my sadness. I go in churches as a tourist to look at art made in your name. One Good Friday, I stood in back with my arms crossed, and an angry man made me unfold them. If that's all it takes to diss you, I'm in big trouble. We don't get to see the purple Jesus very often, though when I smoked a lot of pot, I imagined I saw him often. I meant no disrespect. I mean no disrespect. Lord, have mercy. Christ, have mercy. If I was going to rise from the dead, spring would be the time. I'm writing a name in the layered sunset. Mine, not his. Silver Jesus. The sun turns olive leaves into reflecting silver medals, like the ones I wore around my neck. They bounced against my young thump as I ran the bases. I stayed on the worn paths. I rested on the dirty sacks. Safe. I was safe. Olive leaves don't turn. They don't fall off. And you, Silver Jesus, dead at 33. Old, I used to think. My hair is nearly all gray, but silver sounds better, as if it had value. How can you feel old if you're going to live forever? That's the sort of thing that stops me even now. How much gray hair did you have? The metals tarnished over time. One day they slid into a bottomless drawer. Wherever we stand, we're never safe. Okay, I am not wise and my knees hurt. I don't know which way to bend or whether to kneel at all. Olive leaves shimmer around me in the bright sun. I take my gray head and my creaking limbs out among the gnarled trunks, and I twirl. Orange Jesus. And the first part plays around with the orange as a fruit, too. We all see the skin. The question is whether the juice exists. If I grind at the rind long enough, maybe I'll scrape my way through. I hope it's okay to go this route instead of folding my hands, bowing my head, and telling my favorite lies. A young man bounces a ball down my concrete street. The echo equals half a gunshot. Excuse me for being so precise. It's what the city demands. When he stares at me, I stare back until my eyes lose focus. Between us, the angry sound waves of that orange ball waver in heat. Smile for the camera, smile for the camera. Orange Jesus snapping the picture for his scrapbook of lost causes, the flash erupting, one blinding moment. It's a relief to stop smiling and ease back into hell. I believe that orange ball is filled with air. It's got a slow leak. I keep pumping, pumping. Orange Jesus, do you really love me like everybody says? I am an orange dog yipping against the random length of chain. Orange Jesus, don't lose patience with my wandering. One day I hope to get lost enough to find you. I swallow the bitter rind. I am learning the meaning of thirst. Half a gunshot, half a dropped hymnal in an empty church. The orange edges of the pages flapping, settling. I slice open an old basketball and slip it over my head to feel the awkward darkness of a halo. Two more of these. This is Brown Jesus. Brown Jesus, dust of the earth, how do we keep from choking? Dry throat coated, dark moon under the nails, wet mud of the liquid heart, the sun's idea of faith, pure smudge on a child's face, cut hair falling to earth. Brown Jesus, smudge my face with the sound of grit. Brown Jesus, keep me here, pinch between your fingers. Tobacco before burning, sin before ignition. Brown Jesus, will you burn into my favorite ash, or will I? I have faith in the dark sound of a hollow-bodied guitar, but what if it moves me to dance? Brown Jesus, I'm rounding third, headed for home. I'm going to slide. I'm going to at least kick up a cloud. White Jesus. White Jesus is only visible to the naked eye. Smells like bleach and soap and sperm, the clean iron cloth of ceremony. White Jesus is a theory, the fifth base, the finger pointing into space, the wall of unspoken apology, the shirt worn to funerals. My young children wrapped in towels after a bath, waiting to be lifted up. A white sheet blown horizontal, clothespins holding tight against the myth of rising up. If only they'd let go. And a couple others from this book. This is a short poem called The Fall. Might be an appropriate poem to read in Michigan. I assume most of you are familiar with the snow angel as a thing to do in the winter. A couple years ago, I looked out the window from our upstairs window at night and saw the snow angel in a whole new light, The Fall. Tonight, I look down from the upstairs window at the snow angel I fell to make in the yard, now lit by moonlight, glistening. What glorious wings, what a tiny fucking head. You think about it, you got these big old wings, and then your head, no matter what you do with your head, it just makes this tiny dent. And that was really profound to me to understand that. This book is a departure for me. I can say that with some confidence. For better or worse, it's a departure. And there's this one section that's a series of poems that were inspired by Francis Bacon paintings. And he has a painting on the cover, very attractive, screaming Pope there. And I thought I would try out a couple of these that I hope might somehow stand on their own. This is called Hat and Coat. It's just a figure study of a hat and coat lying together. It was the painting. But a number of people I knew were dying around the time I was looking at this, and that probably prompted the poem as much as anything. When all goes limp, when you buy your final can of worms only to spill them in the dirt and watch them roil loose, when you wipe your nose with a handful of dollar bills, then glue them back in your scrapbook, when flowers turn to glass and the world locks itself into parallel lines there's no squeezing between, when the assumption that smothering yourself might possibly be for the best, when you disappear without tricks under your fedora and overcoat, leaving only a large dark lump, when your eulogies are delivered by the skeletal remains of what you once called friends, well then, yes. And this is called Evolution, colon, Two Figures with Monkey. Every light bulb is a hammer pounding in the regret of the smudged chalkboard of last night's blurry binge that put you here, unclothed and stunned, like that tired wasp buzzing against the window. The water tap seems impossibly far away. Our forced smiles crackle at each other. The tin foil of our brains tries to unball itself. Wouldn't it be great if we were in love? Wouldn't it be great if that spring wasn't poking through the mattress? Has anyone ever told you your hair looks like a dead pheasant? I didn't know you smoked dynamite. A monkey walks up the stairs with a male, his smile more like a squint, his chattering more like speech. He carries letters saying no and give. He waits by the side of the bed. Got a buck for the kid, I ask. Can you do anything about that blue hole in the wall, you ask. They call that a window, I say. The monkey vanishes. All that's left is his tail, a stick floating in blue water. My head on your quiet chest, my ear warming, simultaneous breathing. Then, wind in the open door, calling us names, everything we deserve. And two more poems. I'd like to back up into this middle section and read you a work poem, which is maybe more in the tradition of some of my earlier poetry. It's called Night Janitor, McMahon Oil, because this poem is about the first day of real spring in many ways, and this seems like that kind of a day. It's a job where you clean up the office after everybody goes home. Night janitor job. No one working late tonight. I mean, except us, but some say we don't work here, we just clean. Air freshener stinks up the tiny men's room where lawyers piss on the floor. I make the steel shine. Jack vacuums, spot theory, he's done in minutes. I know a few faces here, late nighters with their tired smiles. What are they doing to celebrate this spring evening? We're going fishing. I steal a roll of toilet paper for home. Gravel crunches under us in the empty lot. We spin out for the hell of it. Along the banks of the pine near Tipton Bridge, no bass or pike tonight. We catch bluegills, throw them back. The company brought in Red Adair once, the famous oil firefighter. Everyone donned hard hats for pictures with Red to hang on office walls. There are no pictures with guys holding cleanser posed around a toilet, but I'd like to see one of those. I'd like to see one of those guys piss straight. Jack lost his CETA job working with deaf workers because there is no CETA anymore. He's taught me a few signs. I love this, he signs. It's nice that he doesn't have to speak. Jack gets letters about his loans. They burn like any paper. I rest my head in my hands and smell cleanser. Friends passed this job on to us, a couple who got better jobs and moved on. This job, not enough to live on. We both work days, minimum wage. Every 3 months you can steal one can of coffee, our friend said. We will leave this job as soon as something comes up. That's a wish, something to come up. Tonight, I wish my hands smelled like the river. I let them drag in cold water, but it's not enough. If I catch enough fish and let them go, my hands will smell like fish. That's the deal I make tonight, or maybe just my wish. The fish slide out of my hand and flop back into the dark river. If I am a fish, I am a bluegill. If you've ever fished, you've caught a bluegill. And if it was your first fish, maybe someone let you keep it, if it was big enough. Most likely, you threw it back, if it didn't swallow the hook. It's my goal never to swallow it. Ten bar at the pine knot and slide just a picture or two. I would like to be in love tonight, but I will settle for my hands smelling like hands. I will settle for a new roll of toilet paper, the soft kind, my bonus to myself. Instead of a cleaning service, they settled for us. We work cheap, settle too easily. The office keys rattle in my pocket. They're all right, the ones I've met, sweating over figures. Tonight, I want to be generous like the river and let things be. Before we get in the car, we stand for a moment and listen to water rushing past below us. My hands smell a little like fish, a little like cleanser. I cup them against my face while Jack drives. "You praying again?" he says. It's a joke. He's never seen me pray. "Yeah," I say. I want to make a joke, but I just say, "Yeah." And this last poem I'd like to read is the last poem in this book. It's about my, I suppose, my fascination with water fountains. Or not water fountains you'd get a drink from, but you know, fountains. Simply called Jet of Water. I am in love with any fountain. I am promiscuous with fountains. I have made my wish. I have crossed my coin. I have witnessed the small splash. I am in love with the simplicity of fountains. Water into air, a dribble or a shot, release, release, repeat, mist, vague breeze. Let me take you there. Let me take you there. Lit by evening and fragile sin, lit by the one forgiving eye. And if we wade in the pool, and if we wade in the pool, will we receive a saving grace? Will we give a saving grace? Oh Lord, when I die, leave the water running. Thanks. I'm supposed to answer any questions that anyone might have, so if anybody has any questions, I'll be happy to attempt an answer. It's always hard to get that first question. Peter?
Maybe I didn't hear correctly. You said the book was Francis Bacon?
Yeah.
How did you get involved?
Reluctantly, I'm sure. Well, I was traveling. I was in London, and I went to the Tate Gallery, and I saw a bunch of his paintings, close up and personal. And they really kind of haunted me in a strange way. For those of you who don't know his work, he paints really disturbing, kind of grotesque. They're not the kind of thing you'd hang above your couch in your living room. But I had this kind of attraction. I was attracted and repelled at the same time to the paintings, and I kept coming back to them in a way that I took as some kind of a signal. So I just bought a big old book of his reproductions, and I just sit down at my desk every day and start flipping through them and plunge in to the poems. And what happened was a lot of the poems are in these really strange personas. All these voices kept coming up in all these weird scenes and situations. So I guess they freed me up to be less narrative than I typically am in the poems, and allowed me to really explore the subconscious a little more in one way or another. So a lot of times I would forget about the painting after a while, and I took that as a good sign. But and so I hope the poems will stand on their own, because if they don't, they're not successful. But I was really drawn to the work in a way that I wanted to try and figure out through writing about it, writing my way through them.
So it was more of a visual attraction rather than study of his work and what he did and his time. It was much more what you got out of him visually than what you got out of his intellectual.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't want to know anything about him. Apparently, he was a real awful person. Maybe I'll tackle Norman Rockwell next. Well, he's kind of a perverse Norman Rockwell, I think, in a way. Really, the polar opposite. And so for me, you know, that was good. Yeah. Yeah, I'm actually working on a second collection of stories, and so I don't want to jinx it, but I do have some more stories that I'm working on. And Another thing I think that allowed me to loosen up in the new book of poems was that I was writing the stories, and I was writing the stories are really straightforward narratives. And so when I went back to the poems, I guess I ended up being more experimental or just taking more chances and breaking away from the narrative because I'd been working with the narrative so strongly in the stories. But, you know, I've always been attracted to narrative, and my first few books are almost completely narrative poems. So it wasn't maybe that big of a jump for me into the short stories. Though the hardest thing I had, and I continue to have, quite frankly, is revising in a new genre. The thing that I gave up that I really focus in on a lot in the poems is the line as a unit and, you know, how to break it in terms of creating rhythm and stuff like that. But it allowed me to do more with dialogue and character than I felt like I was able to do in the poems before. So the book of stories, in terms of the subject matter, is pretty similar to the subject matter of maybe some of the earlier books in terms of really having a Detroit working class focus. But I was able to, I think, explore it from the new form ended up taking me new places with it, I think. Or maybe not. But yeah, I like making trouble for myself as a writer, and trying out a new form is a good way to do that as anything else. Yes?
Can you say a little bit about some of the triggers for the Jesus poems?
Yeah, geez, I don't know where the hell those came from. Who wrote those anyway? Well, okay, there's a kind of a missing link in that I published this chapbook called Niagara Falls, which is one long poem. And it was a small press, a Dastra press, and I don't think that many people saw it. But that's kind of the missing link for me, because that was exploring the tension between popular culture and issues of faith and religion. I mean, it's like Elvis and St. Francis of Assisi are like the two main figures duking it out in that poem. And so I was continuing to kind of explore some of these issues in terms of trying to find out what to have faith in this life, in lieu of like a traditional notion of God. And it was like a wall I was working against. And I should try and figure out where I started with this in terms of how the series evolved. But again, as a writer, you tap into something and you